Hey, this is Ashley.
Hey, this is Marcy.
And this is School and Life, a weekly podcast about life, love, and occasionally libations. This week in Mentor Moment, I'm talking how to know when to go. Too often, we stay in jobs way past our prime. We feel the itch to move, we struggle to break away, and we feel unsure about what's next for us. But if you know it's time to go, it's time to ask yourself some critical questions about the next steps in your life and in your career so that you can finally get unstuck. In this week's blog and in this week's Mentor Moment video, I talk about the five questions it's important to ask yourself if you're looking to break away from your current career. And these questions really center around accomplishments, the people that you serve, your values and priorities, your compensation in your current role and in future roles, and of course, what it means to transition away from this role. And I think that one of the most important questions in this five question set is really, what was the impact that you had on the organization you're currently with and the people you serve, how you can measure that impact, and how you can leverage that impact in the next iteration of your career. Because so often when you feel fed up in your current role, when you know you're ready to make a transition, when you know it's time to walk away, you are obviously really focused on what's not working right, what's been really frustrating, maybe the lack of impact you are having right now and the fact that you want to have more. But before you make that transition, it's so important to really reflect on the impact that you've already had, the impact that, of the people who have been impacted by you, the people that you've been able to serve, the people who are interested in, who have heard from you over time and whose lives and experiences have been improved by the work that you've done. And it's important that before you walk away, that you measure that impact. Maybe you measure it in dollars. Maybe you measure it in people served. Maybe you measure it in the transformational impact that you've had on their lives. But however you do that, it's so important to leverage, to speak to the impact that you've had and be able to leverage it in your next role. Because when you go on that next interview, they're going to ask you, what did you do in your prior role? What kind of impact did you have? How did you serve? Who did you serve? How were their lives changed? And you want to be able to easily reflect on those stories and reflect on that experience. So if you know it's time to go, make sure you ask, you watch this week's video, ask yourself these five questions and really explore what it means for you to walk away from this role and how you want to be going into the next one to make sure that it's your best one yet. Be sure to go to schoolandlifepod.com/blog to read the full blog post called Life Lessons in Knowing It's Time to Go. And you can watch the video on Instagram.com/AshleyAshire. That's Instagram.com/AshleyAshire to watch the five questions you should ask before you quit. It really does really center your experience, really not so much talking about like healthcare benefits or, you know, how you're going to pay your rent when you make the transition. This is really about like doing some soul searching and really thinking about the impact that you've had, the compensation that you're taking with you, what you're looking for in your next role, and really just aligning your values with where you are right now so that when you go into the new role, it is your best one yet and you're really positioning yourself as the expert that you are. And speaking of being an expert, I'm excited to share that Tatiana O'Haron and I are hosting a webinar this week on Wednesday. That's right, on Wednesday, June 24th at 7 p.m. Eastern. Tatiana and I are hosting a webinar called Leveraging Your CEO Mindset to Advance Your Career. So often it's, people's sort of lack of a strong mindset and positional mindset about where they are wanting to go in their career and in their next steps that really hold them back from advancing. And so we're going to talk about some of the best practices of being a CEO and how you can translate those mindset strategies into advancing your career in the world of work. Tatiana is a agency and a sort of team member, team expert guru. She really talks to women in particular about how to grow their companies and organizations, and you know what it means to be a CEO. And of course, we're taking all of the things that she's learned in her space in the CEO, in training female CEOs, to teach you how to use those same tactics in your job and in your career. And so I'm really excited to be able to help you know my mentees by introducing them to Tatiana and talking about what it means to have a CEO mindset and how to leverage that mindset to advance your career in your job today. And so you can register for that webinar at ceomindset.mentor-me.org. It is a free webinar, but registration is required. So just go to ceomindset.mentor-me.org to grab your free ticket and register today. So next up in I Digress, we are talking The Kids Are All Right. On this week's episode, we're going to talk about Gen Xers and how we know that Whitney was right. News is swirling that Gen Zers bested 45 this weekend when they bought out his Oklahoma rally and then didn't show to ensure that there were empty seats all over the amphitheater for his fear-mongering speeches. Plus five teenage girls, actually ages 14 through 16, are hosting rallies and protests and boycotts in Nashville to protect the protest law enforcement lack of inaction on behalf of Breonna Taylor. And we know that we have given generations before us a lot of grief on school and life and talked to them on all the ways that they need to school life a little better. But we're really proud of the work that Gen Zers and Xers are doing right now to really do a lot of social activism, and we wanted to give them a shout out and talk about the amazing work that they're doing. So let's kick it off by sort of talking about some of the recent youth-led protests, Marcy, and why it's so important that they've been led by young people.
Yeah, I think it's so important because a lot of times, I know, I think it's the boomers, I always get confused by what generation is what. But I think that a lot of times we underestimate, and I say we, including myself, just youth in general, oftentimes we don't necessarily always give young people credit for what they're capable of and what they're able to do. And even when I just think about, like, generationally, if you think about being in the Black home, how children are often told to, like, sit down, be quiet, don't say anything, know your place, know your role. And so this idea that children are leading a movement, I think it's often just a underrated, underestimated kind of thing. But when you really think about history and you really think about the ways that movements have come up in the past, it's not always older people that are leading these movements, right? Like Martin Luther King was young when he was doing this work. Like we were talking about like college students and honestly like high school students doing this work in the past. So this isn't new. It's just really like exciting and really heartfelt to see youth leading the movement for sure. What about you? Like, why do you think that it's so important?
Yeah, you know, it's so true that like so many of our social movements, so much of social activism is led by young people. And it must be, you know, it feels like racism is so quickly learned at a young age. And these, like, you know, hate groups are recruiting kids, you know, just as fast as they are, you know, logging into TikTok. And so it is so important that, you know, where they can, Gen Zers in particular are really aligning themselves with social activist movements that are justice minded and focused on equity and inclusion in a way that can save us all, that can really fight against like what feels like a lot of oppression and what feels like a lot of sort of hate, right? And in a generation that has always had the internet, in a generation that has always had high tech in the classroom, that their ability to information grab and to get a lot of the right information right the first time and sort of research and find things on their own without having to go through the card catalog is something that I think that they benefit from. And I'm so glad that like we have this generation to be smarter and faster and more, maybe more thoughtful than we are. And I think that we give Gen Zers a hard time just because of age and hindsight, right? Like it sometimes feels like newer, like younger generations are moving so fast and all the time like roasting us, even though like we gave them all the things that they have at their disposal now, but they steady going after us because we don't understand the latest meme. I think it's true that we, even though they've had these tools their whole lives, we are using them and have been using them in really powerful ways that they are just now learning. I mean, Black Twitter, for at least the last 10 years of my life has been a movement. Like Black Twitter has like shifted the culture in so many ways. It, so many trends, shout out to Fleek, started on Black Twitter. And so it really is them learning from us. And I think learning how to do it better and faster and more quickly and in ways that troll, which I think is a real powerful tool, is something that I'm excited to see. You know, just watching K-pop stans, and shout out to the K-pop stans, interrupt 45's rally, and knowing that so many of those stans and so many of that cultural movement is Asian, and knowing the challenges the Black community has had with Asian allies, it's exciting to see them using their powers for good. So, why do you think, Marcy, like that we give them so much flack, and what do you see on the horizon in terms of maybe them, doing us a little justice in the fight towards equality?
Yeah, I don't necessarily know in terms of giving them flack, because I typically, like I've told y'all before, I don't really interact with a lot of like high school students, so I don't really know what they're actually doing in their lives. But what I will say is that I feel very afraid for them, and I think that tends to be the dominant experience that I tend to feel. It's not so much discouraging them from activism, but also just being terrified about their lives. Like the idea that this young woman was sexually assaulted and murdered at the age of 19 because of her role in protest and because of her role in activism, like that's terrifying. And to think that like what we know to be true about protests in the past and like what happens in the midst of those kinds of things, and not saying that that's the only place that you can engage in activism, but with that being so at the forefront, people are literally putting their lives in danger. And to think that a 19-year-old or a 14-year-old may, or, and not even that, like with buying the tickets, right? So if you think about like putting your information in there, and I'm hoping that they were smart enough, wise enough, savvy enough to not put their actual contact information in there. But even if you think about that, like putting your personal information out there, what kinds of things can happen, especially within the age of technology and people find you, like people are losing their jobs just from Facebook profiles, right? So like all of the harm that can come to them, I think that is where the quote unquote flat comes from me. And this is not in a place of discouragement. It's not to say don't do this, and I have to be really mindful of that. But I know that when I think about like young people being on the front lines, the innocence, the loss of innocence, the loss of safety, the loss of protecting them, I think that that is something that really comes up for me, that I have to constantly put in check, because I want them to have these experiences and they're out here doing things that we hadn't even thought of. Like I know some millennials that actually did engage in it as well, but for something like this to be led by 14-year-olds, I think it's dope and it's amazing. But I also just know that that concern for their well-being comes up. But I think that giving them the freedom to let them grow and let them learn and teach them teach them how to be safe, because I also believe that developmentally they're a lot riskier, right? Like they are more impulsive. They have this invincibility. Like that is what happens when you're a teenager and your frontal lobe has not fully developed. And so making sure that we are encouraging and supporting them and telling them like, yes, you are our future. You are, use your wit, use your intelligence, use your savviness to disrupt the systems that you all are not satisfied with, absolutely, and be smart and be wise and be engaged in a way that is safe and is protecting of yourself. And I just wish too that we had more dialogue about self-care and mental health and well-being during this time. I think that's something we can continue to do to encourage these children when they're thinking about activism, is also thinking about like, how do you take care of yourself? Because we already know that they spend so much time on social media. Like we already know that they're already consumed in that way, but social media is such a big way for them to promote their activism. And so how do we teach them, make sure you take care of yourself in the midst of this? Because if you're starting at 14 with this fight, by the time you are, check our age, like by the time you're in your 30s, by the time you're in your 40s, your 50s, this is not going to be over. It's not going to be done. So you don't want to burn out having 4 decades worth of fight. And I know from people who are in the boomer generation who were active during the civil rights movement and things of that nature, they're tired. And they're basically like, girl, y'all can have that. Like y'all go ahead and march during this fight, but I know that they weren't taking care of themselves. So I just really hope that as we encourage them to keep this fight going, that we also encourage them to mind their mental health as well. What say you, Ashley? What ways can we encourage and support this wave of activism for our Zoomers?
Yeah, I feel like they grew up on dystopian, like, you know, TV shows and robot, you know, body takeovers. I feel like they're in this for the long haul. Like they know what's up. And I feel like they're being much more subversive than, you know, I would think to do. You're right. I'm not attaching my name to nothing. I won't even say that man's name out loud. I'm not attaching my name to nothing that would possibly connect me to him in any way. But the fact that, you know, my, 15-year-old sister might in a way to troll, perceived president of the United States is something that I am just really fascinated by. And I think that, like I said, you know, just knowing that there's just so many angles to come at it. And there's so many ways to be an activist today, gives me hope, because I think that, you know, I think about all the things that this generation has endured, you know, all of the school shootings, all of the economic crisis, all of the climate change issues, you know, all of the racism and the sort of the different generations, all of which are still working and many still having babies and still, like, you know, engaging in this fight with them. I feel like they can see the forest for the trees and they sort of know what's up. I think that they won't get duped in the same ways that we've gotten duped in the past. And I don't think that, I'm not saying that, you know, no issues will befall them, but I'm optimistic. And I'm optimistic just because I think that they have as much activism as they have apathy. So I feel like they'll be okay because they not finna let this best them. They gonna vibe out and do nothing. And then they gonna come and with a sneak attack and then they're gonna do nothing. And so, like, I definitely think that they'll be well rested for the fight. And I think that, you know, one of the things that you talked about that millennials, maybe we haven't quite figured out is like practicing that rest and practicing that selective apathy and practicing that like selective rage and things like that. I think that it's just so much to care about. And so many of us are caring about everything. Plus, I think that we are still super duper leaning into images on social media, where I think that, you know, Zoomers are a little bit more flexible about their image. They're not so much the traditional influencers like millennials are. I think that they are a little bit more like less concerned about their image and more concerned about the fight. And so I think that that's something that they'll benefit from. In terms of what we have in common, though, I do think that we are leveraging social media in subversive ways. I think we taught them that and they're just taking it to a whole new level. And that's something I'm excited to see anytime we can. Like, I love the, you know, like the tweets that's like, oh, what's your favorite album? Because mine is seeing Breonna Taylor's Killers being locked up, you know, and I love to listen to it every night. Like, this kind of thing, I love this. These are my favorite kinds of subversive tweets and you know, doing that work right in the face of hate is something I really like to see. Do you think that there's anything that our generation really has in common with Gen Zers or any particular ways in which we're sort of attacking the fight in different ways?
Whew, I have no idea. Yeah, I don't know. Like, y'all know that social media is not my thing. And so I don't, like, I see those tweets. Did I know that they came from Gen Zers? Nope, wouldn't even have guessed it or have known it. But what I do, I hope that the sentiment is shared that this is important. One of the things that I would hope that we have in common with them and what it seems like, which I struggle with. So it seems like in this season we have in common with them is that the fight is relevant. What I've heard from past experiences, because right now it seems like everybody is just all of a sudden waking up to this. And by everybody, I mean everybody that's not Black. So like that kind of skews my perspective because we've been fighting this fight. And I want to say though that the younger generation, like the people who are in high school right now, they share a lot of the same sentiments that we do about the concerns of the world that I feel like was happening before this became on the forefront of everyone's mind. So I've seen Gen Zers talk about like mental health and breaking down that stigma. I've seen Gen Zers, like they were big on cancel culture about like racism. And so it seems like the thing that we have in common is that these things have been at the forefront of our minds for a longer period of time than when Amazon caught on to it. But I think the ways that we're different, like, just like I was saying in terms of developmentally, it's just that we're older. Like we have children that like, not we, but our generation has children that we're also thinking about. We're like in that, we're in that place of maturity where we have jobs that are on the line. Like we don't have the freedom necessarily to do some of the things that I think that they have to do, which is pretty dope because they have the opportunities to have this youthful innocence of, well, I didn't know any better. Whereas we don't, girl, like I still got to go to work the next day. So I can't be putting all this crazy stuff on the Instagrams. So I think that that would probably be the biggest difference is just that like we have a maturity, like we have people that we're responsible for. And I think that it also, it's funny because I saw a tweet that was essentially like, y'all are doing something to a generation that grew up on Nuck If You Buck. And one of my friends, who is a mother of two and a wife, she was like, I mean, yeah, we did, but girl, we not out here Nucking If You Bucking. And that's real. Like, we at home raising families and like starting businesses and all of this. And so, and that's not to like shame them or downplay their efforts. I think that's the reason why youth are the way of the future. Why they're the reason that the movement can be led by them is because they don't have to be home at a certain time to take care of a kid or anything like that. So I think that it's important for us to keep encouraging them and keep guiding them and keep sharing our wisdom with them, not in an effort to scare them, because I do think that sometimes, especially when we think about like Black families and just the hierarchy of relationships in the Black home, is that we can do things that discourage and like even little subtle messages, implied messages that we give. And so I just want us to continue to lift them up and continue to give them platform to have voices too. So instead of like, we're constantly looking for the experts and we're always trying to give like the person with the PhD and the person that's done the most research the platform. But I also think that these kids' lived experiences is something that we should keep amplifying and acknowledging that their voices are valid, because I think that over time, some of us may have had the experience of our voices being silenced, or us feeling like we weren't being heard, or that our voice would matter, or that the decisions that we made wouldn't necessarily influence things. And so I hope that we can instill in them that their voice always matters, and what they're doing is it matters, and that they're worthy of the fight, and that they deserve to be out here doing these things, and not let them not lose hope and not lose courage. So yeah, what about you, actually? Like, how do you think we can support them from making the same mistakes that maybe we've made in the past?
Sure. You know, I just want to lift up six particular teens who organized the protests in Nashville. The Cut did an article on them just a couple days ago. It was called Six Teens Organize a Protest, 10,000 People Show Up. And just from the look of this picture, it looks like there were two white girls and three black girls all in Nashville, Tennessee, who literally were like facing down their parents, engaged in a race riot, and were like yelling in racist face in the street. Naya, Jay, Kennedy, Emma, Michaela, and Z, all ages, 14, as young as 14, Kennedy is 14, and as old as 16, Naya and Michaela are 16. And just that kind of energy to push back and like post a flyer and be like, let's go, like, we going to City Hall. It's just not forethought that I had at 14. And I just to see young black girls feeling so emboldened that they just gonna like circle up with a couple other girls and be like, yeah, so we going down to the Tennessee State House of Representatives to share a couple notes with the kids about what we want. Like that to me just, that literally blows my mind. They had the Nashville mayor announce it and was like, we need a shout out from you, or we will be doing X, Y, Z. I mean, like Emma won plan. Like, and I just, like, that kind of energy is like, I just want more of that. And I think that one of the things that I think we can do is to amplify those voices. Like, when we hear them, when we see them, we can green light them. Right. We do have jobs and responsibilities, which also means that we have more money, so we can fund them. We can go out there and sit down like two cases of water and like fund the movement. We can share their tweets. We can engage in their work where it feels important, or where it feels appropriate, but not like stealing, you know, their work from them. And like, we can, even in smaller ways, we can amplify their voices. So yes, not every young black girl is going to, you know, stand up a protest and 10,000 people are going to show up, but she might want to, you know, call her representative, or she might want to share something on social, or she might want to have a dialogue with you about what's going on in the world and how it impacts her. And I think that is so, like, anytime we can encourage that and foster that, or even cultivate that, because not even every young person is even thinking about that. But when we have an opportunity to engage them in that work, I think that we should. And I think that the other thing that I just kind of reflect on is, even when we feel like they may not be watching, they are. Like, they watch, you know, our movement, they watch what we shame, they watch what we amplify, right? Like, so they're watching all the time, and the collective eyes are on us, millennial black women. I'm talking to y'all, us, we. And I think that, you know, whenever we can, being thoughtful about how our voice carries, or what our voices are saying and how they carry, is so important, because unfortunately, I guess, and I think that it was the Atlantic that had their cover. It was like, you know, the faces of the movement, and it was all black women and children. And too often the movement does look like that. Black women and children doing the work, fighting forward. And if the children are all right, then we have to be too, because we stand right beside them. You know, the more that we can do to amplify young voices or amplify our own voices when ours align with theirs, the better. And we digress. Next up is All Black Everything. Marcy, what do you have for us this week?
So this week in All Black Everything, I just want to highlight Black women just still breaking down barriers. So Danielle Givers, I believe her last name is, she is the first Black woman student body president at MIT in the school's 159-year history. So in 2020, we are still being the first Black anything, and I just think it's important to acknowledge her. She's a rising college junior majoring in mechanical engineering, which is also dope, and in product design. Or as they say at MIT, course 2A. She also, she talks a lot about, in this article that I've read about her, she talks a little bit about what it was like to quote unquote survive high school. And she said she went to a predominantly white high school in Miami. And she said that she had a pretty moderate experience, but she never had any Black teachers. And she experienced a lot of her peers using the N-word. And what I just find to be, I find it to just be interesting that this article is coming out around the time that we're talking a lot in society about like microaggressions and some of the subtle racism and constant racism that we're experiencing. And so to hear this young woman speak out about those experiences just, again, validates some of those things. Yeah, and she talks a lot about just her experiences and what she's been through, but her decision to want to come to MIT and create a space for Black students. She says she decided that she wanted to be president, but she was just a little scared. But when she was given the opportunity, she just stepped up and decided to do it and told herself that she could do it. So I just really appreciate even, and then she was also elected like during coronavirus. She was leveraging social media. She had Zoom calls, and just like they did 12 hours a day of Zoom calls for anyone that wanted to like open up and talk to them for like open hours and Instagram Live. And I was just like, okay, girl, you better be down here and committed for the cause. So she successfully won her election, and she is like a stunning Black woman and just out here being smart and being amazing and saying, I am just going to break down all these glass ceilings and continue to make history for our generation. So there you go. Congratulations, darling. We are so proud of you.
And she's talking about she was scared. Not for long. You said she's a rising junior. She wasn't scared for long. She quit, made four semesters. Well, probably three, because she was elected in her fourth semester. So yeah, girl, I love it. You was doing it scared. You weren't scared for long. I mean, that is literally amazing. And MIT, 150 plus years and never a Black woman at the helm. Imagine what they've been missing out on. Imagine how much she's going to bring to this organization. I mean, they've been missing out on so much. Oh, well, congratulations to them. They probably don't deserve it, but they must be honored to have her. Congratulations. Congratulations to MIT. You're welcome. That a Black woman would grace you with her student body president graces. So next up is TVT. Marcy, you told me that you watched something this weekend that I would never watch. Very scary. Would not recommend, but I'm excited to hear you talk about it and how it probably ties in our All Black Everything and our I Digress topic this week. So I'll let you take it away.
Yeah, so over the weekend, we watched a documentary called Horror Noir. Mm-hmm. So y'all know I love a good horror film. Like, love them. They make me so happy. I know that's a little bit like an oxymoron, but they really do. I really enjoy them. So wanted to watch this documentary, and within like the first couple of minutes, I was already hooked in, because it wasn't just, like, I'm thinking we about to go run through all of the Black scary movies over the course of time and tell me about how I need to watch all of them. And that's really not what it was at all. It actually talked a lot about Black history, and how, like, the history of being Black in America really created the plot and the themes for these horror films. And one of the first things that they said was Black history is Black horror. And I was just like, whoo, like, literally my response was, whoo, because it is. Like, they started off talking about the birth of a nation, which I've never seen. And I know that, like, it is a part of history and it's one of those classics, but I really have no idea interest in watching it. And it's about basically white mobs murdering a Black man, and it's a white man in blackface, which is why I still don't understand how people can think that blackface is not extremely offensive. But anyway, a white mob killing a Black man for lusting after a white woman. And so it makes you just think about, like, the ways that these different narratives have shown up in, like, reality as well as in film. So if you think about, like, Black men being murdered for lusting after white women, you automatically think about Emmett Till and all of the men in between, the Black men in between that time that have been murdered, even with the suggestion of lusting after white women. And so they essentially go chronologically from that point to just talk, like, about some Black movies that I've never even seen before, which is really dope. But then it also talks about films like King Kong and Creature from the Black Lagoon that don't necessarily have Black characters in them, but are stand-in for Black people and for white folks, like, fear of Black people. And then it continues to move on to one of my favorite sections, I don't know why, but it was about the Blaxploitation genre of the 1970s and how they started to, like, codify Black stereotypes of the pimp and the hoe, or, like, Black women being sex demons, which I was like, oh my gosh, if you think about, like, the ways that Black women are either, like, asexualized or hypersexualized, and then adding on this layer of, like, demonicism, I don't know if that's actually a word, but I'm making it up, adding that on to their sexuality and just the way that Black women are treated now sexually, like, it was just so dope. And again, we're not even really talking about horror movies that much, but at the same time, they were talking about horror movies. They also talked about East Bayou, which is one of my favorite movies, so that was really good. And I'm trying to think, there was another movie before I started talking about some of my favorite horror movies that they talked about. There was another movie, and I cannot think of the name of it right now, but it was the first time that they saw a Black male be, like, the hero. And he ended up being murdered at the end, which made me really sad. But Night of the Living Dead, I believe that's what it was. It was like these zombies. Yes, they were like these zombies. And he was protecting this household. And it was a Black and white film. So it's back in the day where you never would have seen a Black man in the lead role, like, taking care of business and being a hero. But that was the first time that actually happened. And so that also transitioned into some of the other films that came out where there were Black men actually being, like, strong and taking charge and not just being the one lusting after or being the monster in the films. They also talked about Blackula, which I have not even seen Blackula, but I really want to, now I really want to go watch all of these movies. And so then they transition into kind of talking about some of the more popular scary films that we know of. So Candyman, of course, which is about to make its resurgence. I forgot, look, quarantine really messed up my movie life, because Candyman was supposed to come out in, like, May. They pushed it back to September. So now I gotta wait all the way to September to see this. But anyway, talked about Candyman, talked about Tales from the Hood, which hands down is literally one of my favorite scary movies. And even in that, what was also really cool about it is that it had, like, Black actors and actresses in the audience talking about these films. So Rachel True from The Craft was in there. Ken Foray from Dawn of the Dead was there. William Crane, who actually played Blackula, Rudy I don't know how to say his last name, Condias, we'll kind of say, from Tales from the Hood. So people who were like Black directors and actors, and even in thinking about like the people, there were also academics who, there's one lady talked about, she teaches a Black horror class, and I was like, yes, can I take this? Are y'all offering this online?
Because
I
would Marcy, like, you about to go get another degree.
A whole other degree. I know I have a background in theater art, so this would be nothing for me to go and do this. But yeah, so it does all of that and just talks about, like, it keeps just juxtaposing these different movies with things that are happening in society. Like, there was one movie, and I'm not recalling what the movie actually was, but you saw scenes of them like hosing and spraying down and putting dogs on these zombies, but it was directly reflective of what was happening during the protest and during the civil rights movement. So like putting those two things right up against each other, it's like, wow, what is happening in these films is just such a direct reflection of what's happening in society. And so we work our way all the way up, of course, to Get Out. And yeah, like Get Out was phenomenally one of the best scary movies, and then we ended up watching Get Out after we finished watching this. But it's so scary because it talks about like the Black experience. Doesn't have any monsters in it. Like there's no classic quote-unquote fear in there, but it's the fear of being a Black person in America and being in predominantly white spaces and the things that we have to experience. So I just really appreciated seeing this new perspective, or not, I don't know if it's a new perspective, but just a different perspective around what Black horror is and the ways that it's shown up in society and the ways that it's shown up over time and the roles that Black folks have played in cinema and in movies overall. And then kind of similar to what we were talking about in I Digress, and just like people making history, are just the ways that Jordan Peele has opened the door for Black horror, like the ways that the movie has sold out, the response that Us got, the response to Get Out got, the response that I'm sure Candyman is going to get, being able to see us in these different roles and to be able to say like Black directors and Black writers can make this. It just busts open the doors for this new generation to be able to come up and create these new things. And I'm just really excited to see where it's going.
Yeah, you know, as you were talking about that, so many flashes of just like past experience popped up for me. So one of them, as you talk about sort of how Black women are exploited, like in media in particular, as it relates to like horror. So you're right, like we're either the mammy, the docile mammy who's like taking care, or we're like this sexual savage beast. And that reminds me of Savage, the song, and sort of how like the whole theme is around like being sexy but being a savage, like we're not taking no mess, like it's animalistic, we're like, you know, it's not sweet and sexy, it's overpowering, and that's the way that we engage in like intimacy, right? Even though that's not always true, right? And then I remember one of my favorite podcasts that I often listen to, it's NPR's Code Switch. They had an episode called Fear in the Age of Real Life Horror. If you haven't listened to that, Marcy, you absolutely need to listen to it. It's 30 minutes of what I know you will love, and episode released October 30th of last year, so right before Halloween, and it talks about Black fear and Black life, what fear and horror means in the lived experiences of Black people. But it talks about it set as a as like a horror film, like it, like the way the episode rolls out is like a horror film. So you will love this. I don't know how I actually got through this to even talk about it, but I actually really loved it too. It was really good. And, you know, I think that there are so many good Black stories to tell, but so many of them, unfortunately, right, are set in fear. And that's not because our lives are scary or that being Black is scary, but it's because being white is, or like whiteness and white supremacy more specifically are juxtaposed against, you know, Blackness. And in fact, Rachel Cargill, who is a really excellent public academic, I follow her on social and she does some really great work there. She recently shared on her Instagram about how she was at a film festival last year, and it was for like new Black voices in cinema, and almost all of the films were horror films. And like all these, you know, she talked about how like, you know, watching, they were all horror films, and I'm using air quotes here, but like all of the films were like true stories. Like it was the Black experience in different decades at different times, but it was all like a horror film. And she just talked about how the films were about police brutality and Hurricane Katrina and police shootings and gentrification. And as she was watching it, she like saw herself and saw our stories on the films. But then in the second day of the film festival, like there were like private screenings the day she watched it. And then the second day it was like public screenings, and it was just like amphitheaters full of white people. And she just talked about how like the experience of watching it in the pre-screenings, where she could kind of like see it and intake it with the directors and the writers and the actors, and it felt like this really private space. And then to have other people watch our horror stories and how horrible that was for her, and how painful that was just really interesting. So much discourse, right, going on around a lot about this, so much dialogue. And I think that whatever our stories are, horror in nature, otherwise, they're important to be told. So I'm glad that you brought that up. So it's called Horror Noir. Is that right? Yes.
Yep, Horror Noir. I don't know like what all platforms it's on. We watched it on Apple TV.
Okay.
I know that Apple TV, though, is giving a 7-day trial. So if you, for free, I would really encourage it, because y'all know, like I said, everybody's woken up to the fact that racism exists in the world. And so they have this like amazing lineup of just like documentaries and films and shows. And it's not all Blaxploitation stuff. It's actually like really like solid programming. So I would definitely recommend that if you are just wanting to explore some new stuff, or you just need something that's entertaining and new, I would definitely recommend trying out the 7-day free trial. I have no idea how much it costs after that, but you can get some good things in 7 days.
I know, you ain't going to work, you don't got much else to do. That wraps up this week's episode of School and Life. Thank you so much for listening. We hope that you smiled on this week's episode. We hope that you thought a little bit. And of course, we hope that you schooled life a little better. We are still in the midst of celebrating our 3-year anniversary. I just saw a Facebook like story, like rewind or whatever. I think it was June or July 14th last year that we celebrated our 2-year anniversary, or 2 years ago when we celebrated our 1-year anniversary. So it's hard to believe that we've been in this game so long. We're definitely toddlers and very proud of that. So thanks so much for listening. Continue to rock with us. Make sure you share School and Life with a friend. We're looking to grow the platform. We want to connect with more listeners all the time to make sure that we can help them school life a little better. So make sure you share the podcast in your Facebook group, share it in your group chats, because we want to grow the podcast and connect with more members of the class. Thanks so much for listening. Have an amazing week. School's out. Class dismissed.